You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day. It is August. It is nice out there. But you know, Don, we were in the hundreds.
We hit 100 degrees. Yes, we officially did on Saturday and Sunday. Davis had not actually officially hit 100 degrees. Using the weather station that I prefer to use, which is the CIMIS weather station, C-I-M-I-S, we'd hit 99.5 a couple of times, but not 100 degrees. But we did. And let's start with the current weather. Lois and I are preparing this program on August 13th for broadcast August 14th, 2025. And it's going up to a high today of 87 degrees and sunny.
Now, you see, that's what happens. Our average for August is 92. Mm-hmm. And if that's the average, we have to have some in the 80s and some in the 100s.
Yes, you know? We have to have some days below average to make up for the ones above average. Yep. So the weather for this coming week is looking pretty balmy. It's going to be on the day of the broadcast, 90 degrees, which is 1-2 degrees below average, I believe. Thursday night will be 59 and clear. It's going to be clear and sunny throughout, no clouds in the horizon. Friday will be 95, and that will be the hottest day of the next several days. Friday night will be 61, Saturday 89, Saturday night 61, Sunday 86 and sunny, Sunday night clear 57, Monday 87, Monday night 58, Tuesday 88. So days in the upper 80s, one day 95 degrees, a couple degrees below average for the next few days, continuing this long string of days below average here in the Sacramento Valley in Northern California. How many days over 100 degrees? Well, using my weather stations, the ones that I prefer to use for apples to apples comparison, since I track all this information, Davis has had 2 days over 100 degrees. Dixon, which is 12 miles to the west of Davis, has had 3 days over 100 degrees. Woodland, which is about 10 to 12 miles north, actually it's about 6 miles north at this point, of Davis, has had for those of you out of the area, there's a joke locally that Woodland, which is growing rapidly in housing, is North North Davis. That's what the realtors like to refer to it as. But they've had 4 days over 100. Winters, which is to the west of us, about 15 miles, has had 7 days over 100. Fair Oaks, which is on the other side of Sacramento, and Fresno, which is way down in the valley, have each had 10 days over 100 degrees. I say this just to illustrate the effect of the Delta breeze. The weather looks great for the next week or so. People are really enjoying this balmy weather here in Northern California. It was kind of funny hearing people complain about 100 degree weather in the second week of August, as if it was something new or something unusual.
They were new. That's the thing.
Yes. We have a lot of people that come to town in the month of August. In fact, at the end of August, it's big move in, move out day here in the Davis area, because UC Davis, that's when most of the leases turn over. And we start to meet a whole lot of folks that are new to the community. If you happen to have found KDRT and you're listening to the Davis Garden Show, welcome. If you got questions about the area, send them to davisgardenshow@gmail.com. Most of your questions, I've noticed, are about houseplants at the moment, but some of you are renting places with yards, and you've just moved to a place with an amazing range of things you can grow. Yes, let's just leave it at that. We're just at the start of a planting season, and I know there's some folks moving here from other places. Where August doesn't seem like the start of a planting season, well, I suggest you check out the calendar at redwoodbarn.com, which is right there on the homepage. You can look every month and see what garden opportunities there are, see what's blooming in August. And of course, tune in to the Davis Garden Show. And I do also write enterprise articles, articles for the Davis Enterprise and such, which usually focus on what to do now. In fact, I'll be doing one this week of what to do in the middle of August in your garden. And I do,
of course. Don, you forgot. Farmer Fred.
Yes, he's a great resource. Fred Hoffman.
And Don's going to be on his show.
That's correct. He has me on a couple times a year to talk about mostly tomatoes. That's my big theme with Fred. He and I are avid tomato growers, and we've known each other for more than 40 years. And we always like to chat about what's up, what's down, what's working well, what isn't. And in weird years, and every year is a weird year, we talk about how it's affected the tomato production. So this program, which I'll be on recording later today for broadcast probably next week, I'm sure one of our topics will be an unusually cool summer in the Sacramento Valley. How did that affect your tomato production? And again, tomato yields are only halfway done. We've got fruit coming in all the way until early to mid-October. KDRT is community radio. That's public radio. We rely on contributions from listeners like you to fund our operating costs. If you like what you hear, if you like all the great programming at KDRT, and I urge you to go to kdrt.org and look at the schedule and all the amazing programs. And while you're there, just click on the support button and send us some money. We always appreciate that. Lots of great programming over there. Lois, you do a show called That's Life, which is one of our public affairs shows.
Yes, I do. And when I don't get around to editing up the interviews that I have sitting on my computer, which have been there for many weeks, then they'll play a repeat. Mm-hmm. And so the last couple of weeks, I've been having an interview with Jitan, who is another one of our producers here at KDRT. So even if I'm not there in person, but there'll always be something on. Mm-hmm. Tuesday noon is when That's Life is on. And if you want to see older shows, the archives are at kdrt.org. Just look for That's Life. Search for Lois. That's the easiest way.
Yeah, that's a public affairs show. So they stay there, like the Davis Garden Show, which is considered public affairs, forever. Now, the music shows only hang out for 2 weeks. I do Jazz After Dark on Tuesdays at 8 p.m., and it's there. You can sign up for a podcast. But those shows are only on live, you might say, or accessible for 2 weeks. And there's a lot of great music programming. I mean, that's what KDRT is really, you know, in terms of the number of programmers, that's our big deal. Yeah, I always like to highlight one of the interesting programs because there's such an eclectic range of music on KDRT, the kind of thing you only hear on public radio, not commercial radio. Classical excursions for classical music fans. We have an amazing resource right here. Greg Luttrell, who's a classical music composer and visual artist. He's written ballet scores, symphonies, band pieces, concertos, and chamber music. Well, now he comes on over and does a classical radio program. Most of them on commercial radio focus on well-known light classics, as he puts it. They ignore the challenging and imaginative masterworks from the rich repertoire of 20th century music, which is very diverse. Well, he wants you to become aware of the many wonderful works that are out there. So Classical Excursions presents short and longer works by famous as well as less known composers, with insightful commentary by a composer with years of experience in radio, classical marketing, and music education. That's 2 hours every Friday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., and there's a podcast link for Classical Excursions here at KDRT.
That sounds wonderful, Don. Yeah.
Yep. Okay, we have a bunch of questions that have come our way, and we have comments and follow-up and all kinds of stuff. So you've got it all laid out in front of you. Let's get going on some of these questions.
Before we do that, I have one more public service announcement. And you mentioned Farmer Fred, who had a radio show for many years that Don would go on, and now he retired from that show, and he's doing other stuff. But boy, is he busy. And he has a newsletter called Garden Basics with Farmer Fred. Mm-hmm. And I encourage you to go and check it out. If you all are interested in getting more information about Farmer Fred, go to gardenbasics@substack.com. That's his email address.
It's always fun to be on his show because we can swap notes about problems, but also things that are doing well. I mean, for example, right now in my garden, my pest is ground squirrels. We've worked together, the ground squirrels and I, to come to a mutual understanding. As long
They
as
eat, you plant, right?
I plant, they eat. They only seem to eat some of the fruit that's more or less at ground level, and they eat the whole thing. You know, they're pretty well-mannered animals as far as it goes. If I'm of the pests that I deal with on my property, which are turkeys, ground squirrels, gophers, and some tree squirrels and occasional tree rats. That's kind of my litany right there. I would say ground squirrels are my favorite of that group to deal with because the damage that they do is manageable to a degree. But right now, every day when I go out there, don't worry, folks, we'll get back to our usual topics in a minute. Every day when I go out there, one tomato has been half eaten. And if I go out there the next day and I haven't done anything, that rest of that tomato is gone. Well, you know, if all of our pests would just do that, I think we'd be a lot happier. These aren't vandals like your tree squirrels, which come in, take one bite out of each green tomato and knock them onto the ground. No, one red tomato. Okay, we can work with that. But one thing I have adopted is for the plants that are down at that end of the garden, if it's a variety that I care about, and particularly if it's a large fruited one where I have high hopes for that particular fruit, I'm picking it early. And I'm going to emphasize this when I'm on Fred's show as well, because this deals with heat issues and it deals with certain pest issues. So if I'm growing a new one like Genuine, which is an amazing, appears to be an amazing new hybrid, large fruit, beautiful fruit, I'm not going to wait till that 12 to 14 ounce tomato is fully ripe on the vine because I know that about 2 days before that, the ground squirrels will probably figure it out and start taking bites out of it. No, once it goes off of green to the early breaker stage or to just beginning to turn yellow, I pick it and I bring it in and sitting on the counter right now. And it takes 3 to 5 days from that stage, 5 to 7 days from an earlier stage, it'll ripen on my counter. There are no ground squirrels in my kitchen. There are no tree rats in my kitchen. So I know that this beautiful tomato will ripen fully. And I really recommend for those of you that are frustrated by squirrels in particular, rats to some degree, and also sun scald on the fruit, pick early. Pick them after they've gone off of the deep green color, already beginning to turn color, pale yellow, even into yellow and orange. Generally speaking, those pests will not go after them until a little further along in the ripening process. If you got one of those ones, like, here's an idea, stick your cherry tomatoes down at the end. You'll have enough for everybody. But early harvest is actually a good answer to some of these pest problems, other than barriers and whatnot. That was a digression. Lois, what do we have to talk about today?
Oh, we have so much to talk about today, as always. I have an email here with pictures. Thank you for the pictures. Evelyn from Davis writes, I have a Satsuma mandarin tree that is over a year old, and like some strange long-term relationship, I've invested time, water, and no small amount of hopeful glances in its direction. Unfortunately, after last July's brutal heat wave, it shed most of its leaves like a jilted lover tossing my sweaters into the street.
Folks, you get marks for creative writing when you send these
I
emails
wonder if Evelyn is a professor on creative.
in.
I mean, I love the way this. Okay. Since then, it has not so much bounced back as it has slightly twitched. There are a few new leaves, brave, stoic little things, and the overall vibe is more post-apocalyptus bonsai than bountiful citrus beacon. I've attached photos for reference. Please note that any resemblance to a Charlie Brown Christmas tree is entirely coincidental.
Yes.
In regards to watering, well, she knows that's what our first question
First
is.
question, yes.
I have a sprayer pumping out at a good rate 1 hour per week. Now, we looked at the pictures.
Go ahead and keep going. We'll come back to that.
The soil seems saturated. Another point, possibly relevant, possibly not, is that this particular patch of yard was once used as a boat ramp,
Yeah.
meaning that there's about 3 inches of mulch sitting atop 3 inches of rocks before you hit the soil. My question, posed with both horticultural curiosity and a sense of emotional self-preservation, is this: when does one cut their losses and plant another tree? Or is there still some faint horticultural pulse here worth nursing back to life? Sincerely, Evelyn in Davis.
We love your letter, and the picture is great because it shows me exactly what you're watering with, which is a little mini sprinkler. We've talked about these before. When you say sprinkler, at this point in my career, I've learned that it's time to stop and say, do you mean a sprinkler like in your lawn or a sprinkler like goes on a drip system? Because the ones that go on drip are mini sprinklers that put out the water It seems like a lot, but it's nothing compared to what, say, a lawn sprinkler would be putting out. So the word sprinkler needs to be clearly defined. This is the kind of spray bubbler that goes on to drip tubing, and it is a foot or so from the base of the tree. These put out water, yes, at what seems like a pretty good rate over a pretty big area, but they need to run for a couple of hours to give a good soaking. And I believe that Evelyn said that she's running it for 1 hour per week. That it will feel wet at the surface, and we'll get to that in a moment, but I don't think 1 hour per week with a mini sprinkler is enough water for this young tree. I would either add another sprinkler on the other side of the tree or just run it a lot longer or run it a second time during the week. So that's the first thing. I don't think you've been watering it deeply enough, particularly in July of 2024, when we had many days over 100 degrees, one of the hottest Julys on record. And it, yes, that was very stressful for young citrus. I have planted a lot of citrus trees. And every now and then you get one that just struggles from the start. I have experience looking at the root systems of them. I can tell you that citrus roots are fragile. So this may be part of the problem that at the time of planting, it has not been uncommon for us in planting our new mandarin orchard to take a mandarin out of the 5 gallon bucket and have a chunk of the root system fall away. They're never fully rooted in compared to other nursery stock. And part of that is simply that the demand always exceeds the supply. So when growers get something that looks saleable, they send it to market, and I buy it. I mean, as a retailer, if I can bring it in, I'll bring it in, and then I'll take some of these home and plant them and find that the roots are not filling the container and the roots are fragile. So it's quite possible that at the time of planting, that root system was struggling to begin with. So that this isn't your fault. This relationship is not failing because of you. Okay, let's get that part here.
They had baggage.
They brought baggage into the relationship. That's right. And I think that you have a soil problem when you have inches of rock with inches of mulch or the other way around, whichever it was, because you don't have any real soil there until you get down several inches. I always recommend in that situation, pull everything back that's there for an area 3 to 4 feet across. I want all that stuff pulled away at first at the time of planting. So you're planting into soil, not into a mix of bark and rock and soil. I want you planting into your native soil. So that may be part of it, is that it was struggling from the start because of the strange things that have been done in that area. And yes, it will feel moist in the top inch or two. But the question is whether the water that you're providing is going deep enough. Remember that we started this year with an irrigation with a moisture deficit. By the last measurable rainfall in Davis area was the first week of March. We had a little rain in April, nothing really to speak of. So our irrigation season should have started earlier, and soil was dry. When I was going out planting new citrus and other things on my property in late April, early May, I was hitting dry soil down about 12 to 14 inches on my farm. And so I was realizing that in some cases, I would start the hole, and a lot of people do this anyway, but I would just start the hole, fill it with water, go away and do something else, and come back and plant a couple of days later because I wanted to get water down below the tree at the time of planting, not just up at the surface. So that may be a factor, could have certainly been a factor last year. But here's the good news. I have had young citrus that are feeble come back from struggling. Usually it's by pulling away all the weird stuff, making a basin around them, and hand watering them carefully. I always prefer to hand water a young tree that's struggling like this because your sprinkler is probably not covering the whatever roots are there perfectly. So I would prefer to see you get a hose out there and pull the stuff back that isn't soil. Make a basin so water will collect around the tree when you do water. Get a soft rain nozzle or something like that so you can stand there and wash off the leaves because they like that in the summer anyway, and water the root ball and the zone around the root ball because it looks like it's pretty dry around this tree. And do that maybe once a week, either in addition to your irrigation system or replacing your irrigation system. Because when you stand there with a hose, water is coming out pretty fast. In fact, it's coming out faster than it can soak in to a lot of our soils in Davis. If you break that up with something like a soft rain nozzle that turns it more into a shower than a solid stream, that'll distribute it and you'll be better able to cover the area. And as you stand there moving it around, you're making sure that it's covering the area. If it starts to puddle, stop, back off, wait till it soaks in, do it again. So hand watering is going to be more thorough and more effective if you're patient. Most of us find it very soothing to go out and hand water. So I think that you might find this relaxing and it might improve your relationship with this little tree. There is new growth on it. And that's the main thing I'm saying. Now, the new growth is coming on small, it's stunted, but that means that the plant has viable buds and wants to grow. So if it were mine, in addition to what I've just talked about, I'd get some source of nitrogen on there. I would get some kind of fertilizer, whatever you're comfortable with. Fish emulsion is great. Houseplant food would be fine. Yes, citrus food, of course, would be great. And get something on there. Because right now, we're having this conversation in the middle of August. Citrus should be putting on new growth. You should get 1 to 3 feet a year of growth on a young citrus tree. Satsuma mandarins are among the slowest of all. My experience with them is they're typically in the 1 foot a year range. You're not getting that, obviously. So our goal is to start getting 1 foot a year on your Satsuma mandarin. And nitrogen will help. Deeper watering will help. There is potential. I would not give up on this relationship at this time.
Okay, I've got a couple of things to say. One is that little mini sprinkler that you're running for an hour. If you were to, put it in a cup and turn it on for an hour, put it in a jar, see how much you get. It's not going to be a whole lot.
It depends. It depends on the model. And this is the thing that we like these. These are bubbler kind of sprinkler things. We like them because they're adjustable. Oftentimes you can open them out and make them put out more water, assuming it's the kind I think it is, or you can tighten them down to put out less water. So you might just open it out. Some of them have a distribution pattern that concerns me. They make little fingers.
The circular one.
Well, the full circle is great. That's what it looks like. If you get a full circle, then you know that at least wherever it's spraying water, you're getting reasonably even distribution. But some of them have a sort of a star pattern where water is, they use those in bigger orchards and they run them for 24 to 36 hours. They work fine if you're running them for a very long time. But look at the distribution pattern. But a real simple solution to that, if that's the problem, just put a second one on. And they'll overlap and they'll do what you need. So adding a second one might be the simplest thing to do here is just put in another little bubbler sprinkler thing on the other side of the tree and see if that makes a difference.
Well, also the amount of water that you're going to put out when you're out there showering it from a handheld hose, it's going to be a whole lot more than these. I have these little sprinklers.
Yeah.
I have one that looks just like that.
We like them.
It's very nice, but it's not a lot.
No, we use them out front at our nursery. We have, in the flower border out front, we have sprayers where the flowers are because they distribute evenly. And we have these things in the back of the bed. And for me to use them to water the larger plants in that bed, we run them for 4 to 6 hours to give a really thorough soaking. This young tree doesn't need that yet, but it needs more probably than what it's been getting.
Well, I don't think you saw this, Don. Look at the fourth picture, the one that's pulled away a little bit. Yep. Look at that plant behind it, and its leaves are totally wilted.
It appears to be, yeah. Yep.
I think this whole section, this whole area is dry.
Well,
and
this is...
Would it be a good idea just to get that whole thing wet for a while and let it?
Yeah. We talk about this all the time. This is another sort of I call them my citrus in a desert pictures because there's nothing around the plant and it looks like bare soil out as far as we can see. Now there's a lot of bark there, which does help retain moisture, but by July or August, that soil is dry. You could set a sprinkler out there. You could stand there with a hose and hand water. And again, I like to emphasize this, washing plants off, watering by hand is really beneficial in your garden. It encourages soil microorganisms. It encourages beneficial insects on top of the plant that you're trying to grow. So washing this plant off, giving it a good soaking, taking a minute to water the bark that's all around it, setting it on the plant behind, which looks like a banana or something, giving it a good soaking, I think that would make a big difference. I think water distribution is part of your problem and the depth of irrigation is another issue. And then you have this confounding factor of bark and gravel on top of soil. So there's some issues here, but I think we can correct this because this plant is trying to grow. That's the good news. I mean, I had to pull a few of the mandarins that we put in 2 years ago that had just struggled from the start. And then we got to 23 degrees in January of this year. And that was kind of the end of it for some of them. On the other hand, some that I was going to pull are flourishing now. I looked at them. There was growth. They had dropped a lot of leaves. They were struggling with a small number of them, but I didn't get around to pulling them. So I pulled the weeds around them and I gave them a quarter cup of citrus food and I hand watered them and I left the hose down there so I could continue hand watering them, even though I was running the irrigation system on the rest of the orchard. And along about the 1st of July, all of the ones that I had been planning to pull started pushing new growth and they look fine. They're flourishing now. So a little nitrogen, deep watering, washing everything off, and getting more moisture around this plant. A recurring theme here on the Davis Garden Show is expanding your watering zone past the plant so the roots can explore the soil. This tree is going to probably explore through the leafy debris and the bark and the gravel to some degree, but we really want it to root into the native soil below.
Okay, so for the listeners who can't see these lovely
Right.
pictures,
Great pictures, yes.
great pictures, yeah. So the main stem of the tree is only a couple of feet tall, and then it has some side branches coming out in several directions. The main stem has been painted white on one side,
Good, yes.
so this is good. The auxiliary stems, the side stems, have not been painted. But the person has put a structure, it looks like it's PVC pipe, maybe it's just sticks, and there's a shade cloth above it. So it's shading the plant, it's not getting full sunshine. So, Don, I want to ask you a couple questions. First of all, with all of the branches that are going to the side, should this be pruned back towards the center?
No, I wouldn't prune it at all right now. We want to focus on
Okay.
new growth. Yep.
And then the shade cloth, is that good, bad, or indifferent?
People get very concerned when young trees are in full sun here in the valley and they'll put up shade cloth. As long as it's 30 to 50% shade and they're putting it up temporarily, I don't think it hurts and may help in extreme heat. Haven't had the extreme heat this year, but we sure did last year. I think this is fine. I'm not concerned about it. We want to focus on new growth. Our goal is 6 to 12 inches at least of growth on this mandarin by the end of this summer. That may be when you, what's the term, cut bait or fish. You might be time to cut bait at that point if it hasn't done that. I will tell you of the seven varieties of mandarins in my orchard, the new orchard that we planted 2 years ago, the slowest growing ones have been the Satsumas, and that's the case. Satsuma mandarins of all the different types, Owari Satsuma, Dobashi Beni, Okitsuwasi, are slow growing trees. By comparison, Tango, Gold Nugget, the others are putting on 3 feet of growth this year and they are flourishing. And the Satsumas are all plugging along 6 to 12 inches, which is fine. They're healthy. So we're aiming with this tree. Let's see if we can get 6 inches of growth on it by the end of this summer. If you can, you're on your way. If it's still struggling, still dropping leaves, going into cold weather, I'm not going to tell you to end a relationship. That's your decision. But you're welcome to come back to us for counseling afterwards.
I have one last question. I don't see any crown. I
Right.
don't see where the stem goes down and meets the roots. That's the crown. And if that is buried under 6 inches of rock and 6 inches of bark, I think you have a problem.
Well, I'm less
So
concerned
pull
about
that away.
I do want them to be pulled away. I'm less concerned about it being buried under 6 inches of bark and rock than I would be 6 inches of soil. So
Right.
we like to see the root flare. I remember a conversation with our citrus grower, Four Winds Growers, years ago. I said, "You keep telling people to plant them high. And what do you exactly mean?" He goes, "I want to see the top of the very first root
Yeah.
exposed." I said, "Really? You want them to see the root?" Yes, because then I know they've planted it high enough. So when they send, when they bring in a picture or whatever, you can actually see the root flare. I don't, as you note, I don't see that, but partly that's because it's undoubtedly buried under what used to be the boat ramp. So pull that all away. Let's get some good, better air exchange in around the surface roots of this plant. Make the basin, deep water it, give it some fertilizer, and let's see what happens by the end of September.
And you can send us a picture once you
Yeah.
pull that stuff away and show us what the what where the root flare is.
Yeah, it
I
could turn
would
out to be a problem area because of what was done to the soil. Being on a farm where there were things done here before we moved in, road beds and gravel and this, that, and the other, you'll go to plant an area, realize, oh, this is going to be a problem. And so sometimes you have to do a little exploring, even a little excavating. So if you happen to take this out and replace it, I would pull back considerable amount of that stuff and start digging down, see what's going on in terms of water penetration, in terms of drainage. many areas where people are listening, they would probably want to do a drainage test first. That isn't usually necessary in most of Davis, but a basic drainage test is to dig a part of a hole in an area, assuming that you've adequately watered so you can even break into the soil. Dig a bit of a hole, fill it with water, and see what happens in 24 hours. And if the water drains in and soaks in 24 hours, then you're fine. If it's still standing after 24 hours, not a good place to plant. There's a couple places around Davis, Binning Tract, North Davis Meadows, parts of Stonegate, some parts of Covell Park, where the soil is heavy enough and there have been things done to it before they built your house or whatever, that you'll find you dig a hole to plant a tree and it fills up with water and doesn't drain. Don't plant a tree there. It will not work. If you have one of those spots, we could talk about bog plants, but it's not going to be a good place for a fruit tree for sure, or most ornamental trees. And so what you have to do at that point is figure out why, in some of the best farmland in the world, you happen to have an area where water isn't soaking in. And the most common answer here, this is local, not elsewhere, is you may have to auger through that or dig down, break through some compacted zone, dig wider and see what the problem is before you plant in that area. There's other places where you dig in, you fill it with water, it never drained. You're not ever going to plant there because that's the nature of your soil. They're just the density of the soil. When I was a teenager, I worked in Rancho Santa Fe, California. You folks know that area down in Southern California? We would dig a hole if And I was one being paid to dig the hole. It was hard work. And very commonly, the drainage was so bad that we would just give up on that spot in terms of planting a tree because of the nature of the soil and the fact that underneath that soil was bedrock. We don't have bedrock here. We don't have hardpan here. So if we've got a drainage problem in the Davis, Woodland, Dixon area, it's usually because something was done to the soil. And that may require some work on your part. Working with a nearby country club, for example, where they had a drainage problem in one area. The decision we made all together was that he was going to go out and get an auger, a two-person auger that had a, I don't know, 8 or 10 inch drill-looking thing, and to start augering down. Because I had learned in this particular area that if you did that, you'd get down 18 to 24 inches, and really hard work, and two people are doing this, and all of a sudden, it would push down into the stuff below that was actually a reasonably good soil, and you would solve the drainage problem. That works here, but there's places where it may or may not work. If you have an actual hard pan, if your plow pan is just too dense, you might actually have to bring in like a tractor or something like that. Or if it's a true hard pan, raised planters are in your future.
So this time when I went to the mailbag, I found this lovely letter from Mary. And she writes, "This avid fan in Folsom sends big appreciation and thanks for your garden advice. I learn something new from your show each week and always look forward to the next one."
Well, thank you. That's very nice of you. We appreciate those kind of compliments.
Yes, we do.
Okay.
So I have a husband who finds things in the newspapers as he reads these national newspapers. And he sent me one, and it's how to waste less water on your lawn this summer. I
How to
read
wait? How
this thing,
to waste less
how
water?
to waste less water.
Okay.
Okay, and I read through this. Done. They're quoting you. It's amazing.
What? Where?
Yeah, everything from a screwdriver to test the how deep it's watered, all this stuff, and it's like I'm reading this and I'm going, somebody's been reading Don. It's amazing. So anyway, I just wanted to thank my husband for sending me this, and thank you, Don, for influencing the world.
Apparently. So what do they tell people in terms
Okay,
of?
it's okay. If the folks are listening to our show, they know all this stuff already.
You're thirsty. Your lawn is thirsty. Oh, this is great.
Okay, yeah. So read that later. We don't
Okay.
need that now.
Okay.
So the other thing we're going to do is look at a catalpa. Now, let me read this. This is from Anne in Medford, Oregon.
Oh, yeah.
I just so enjoy hearing the little ins and outs of gardens on the West Coast. Here I am in zone 8B with a catalpa that was grown in a barrel for several years before being gifted to me about 10 years ago. I planted it right away, but wish I had thought about it being too close to our wobbly fence. It's about 3 feet from that.
It's a
There's
big
a
tree.
lot.
Yeah, that's a
There's
big
a
tree
lot.
ultimately. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot behind the fence that's full of deciduous and evergreen trees. The catalpa has full sun for 8 hours a day in the middle of summer. It gets a good drink about every 6 weeks, a slow drip around the drip line for about 8 hours. The soil is heavy, sticky clay that holds water fine. The
Okay.
area where it's planted is raised about 3 feet above the yard. We had removed all the gosh darn weed fabric within 15 feet of the tree, but the previous owners placed a heavy weed barrier fabric at ground level for absolutely no reason. We learned this when we installed a replacement wall for the stepped-up area. We really couldn't see a way to remove it without tearing the entire shelf and replacing the soil, and we didn't have good access for the equipment. The tree looks absolutely fabulous and blooms nicely all spring. By midsummer, it starts to look ratty and loses leaves. We noticed other catalpas in the area look similarly bad. The following spring, she's back to being lovely. Is this just the nature of the tree? Is the weed barrier we can't remove the problem, so we need to remove it? Should we just suck it up and look at other garden beds and pretend it's okay?
Pretend it's
Maybe
okay.
it's too much water. We've had a very hot 90 to 100 degree dry summers and damp, persistent wet through winter and early spring. Please advise. Many thanks, Anne in Medford. If I can find more pics, I will send an additional email. And she did. So there's a picture of a catalpa, and Donald, tell us what that means. And it's in an area with mulch on the ground, and a fig tree nearby looks good, and the bulbs near it look good,
I
and
see
then
cosmos. Yeah, this is great. Your garden is lovely. Thank you for this picture. And it's a raised planter, so clearly this is not a drainage problem, that the water is draining away. Catalpa is a native tree in the southeastern United States. I kind of fell in love with them when I first moved up here to Northern California, because we certainly didn't have them in southern, in where I was, on the coast of San Diego. And when they're in bloom, it's one of those trees that when they bloom, I can count on someone coming in to ask me what it is. There's a few of them around the Davis area because they have tubular flowers that are showy. They're very pretty. Hummingbirds love them. They set these long seed pods and they get big. It's a very large tree. Catalpa was then crossed with our southwestern native desert willow, Chilopsis, which is also in the trumpet vine family, interestingly, and also very attractive to hummingbirds. And this was done in Russia, interestingly, that they crossed two American species, Catalpa and Chilopsis, to make the Chitalpa. So this gets a little complicated, but the Catalpa and the Chitalpa both get two major leaf diseases in our area, and I can only imagine they're worse in Medford, Oregon. That is anthracnose blight on the leaves and powdery mildew on the leaves. And they kind of go in that sequence. So the anthracnose comes when we have rain in the spring, which you certainly do in Medford, and we frequently do here. As the leaves are pushing out, they get infected. A lot of the leaf is browned and looks ugly. A lot of them drop off, and eventually a new crop of leaves comes on fine. But that does tend to thin out the canopy pretty badly. So while they are blooming nicely, they are beginning to get infected, and then you lose a lot of your leaf area. And then, as soon as the new leaves come on, we start getting into the summer, and powdery mildew shows up. So, we don't sell catalpas, well, primarily because they're just too big for most yards here, but also because of these leaf diseases. And the reason I mentioned that hybridization is that a lot of people go, Catalpa, what a beautiful tree. I want a smaller version. So, they buy the Chitalpa, which is that Catalpa Chilopsis hybrid. Have we lost you yet? Chitalpa gets the same diseases. This is the frustrating part. So, the city of Davis planted some of those around the area. There's some in Central Park. There's one west of Hibbert Lumber for local residents. And it's a lovely tree from about 30 feet away. They bloom a lot. If you get up close, you look at the leaves, and the leaves look unsightly because of anthracnose and powdery mildew. So, the basic answer to your question. Is it just the nature of the plant? Well, unfortunately, yes, it is just the nature of the plant. These diseases are not something you can spray for. They're going to look rough from mid to late spring into the midsummer. The flowers will be fine. The tree is vigorous. The weed barrier is not an issue here. These are just well-known disease problems on catalpa, which limit its utility in residential settings. So pretty much this is one of these rural trees. But I can always tell when the catalpas are blooming because they're one of those trees that people will see the bloom and come in and ask me about it. There's a couple others like Paulownia, the Empress tree, jacarandas, which there's a handful of them around Davis. They'll see this tree they don't recognize. They'll see the bloom on it and they'll be curious about it. And then the question is this something that's suitable for my yard? In the case of catalpa, I would say no. So I don't actually sell them. So they look ratty here, but they still bloom nicely and they're perfectly tough, adaptable, vigorous trees. This one did spend a long time in a barrel. So I am It should be growing 3 to 4 feet a year. It may not be doing that because of having been root bound in the container for a long time. It'll take. I have little doubt about that. I do hope that if it was root bound, you did inspect and correct the roots. That is to say, any that were circling should have been pulled out and allowed to spread out at the planting time. A good drink about every 6 weeks is probably fine for an established catalpa. They actually are often planted on rural properties where they're not irrigated at all here in the Sacramento Valley. So it's a very tough plant, but it'll look better if you water it deeply every few weeks, once a month, something like that. Getting weed fabric out is a nightmare. It's just almost impossible to do. So if you're having a problem with water penetration because of weed fabric, getting in and breaking through it somehow, cutting in, pulling it out in places so that water will soak in is not a bad plan. But I don't think that's a factor in why this tree is looking rough. You're just basically dealing with anthracnose. And on the first picture you sent, I can see it clearly on the leaves. And then powdery mildew is that white powdery fungus that grows on the surface of the leaf later on in the season. It'll be a fine tree there as long as you can put up with this appearance. And you've got such a lovely garden with all these other nice, happy-looking plants that if it were mine, I probably wouldn't have a catalpa there. I would probably have a more attractive eye-level tree with blooms or fruit or something on it to complement the yard better. Hate to have you take out a tree that you might have some sentimental attachment to. So you can certainly leave it. It will grow fine, it will bloom fine, and it'll look like this every year.
So Don, she said that it was in a barrel for many years, and she got it 10 years ago. So this tree is 10 years old. It does not look like a 10-year-old tree, does
Well,
it?
it's spread out
It
quite
looks
a
like it's
bit.
pretty stunted.
Yeah, 10-year-old catalpa should be 20 to 30 feet, and this is more in the 15-foot range. But I think that part of that, yes, could be that the root system was constrained. I would think about replacing this tree. I don't think it's unhealthy. I don't think it's unsafe, but I don't think you're going to be real happy with it because this picture is probably about as good as this is going to look, even when it's twice this big. So maybe that'll be a factor in your consideration. It looks to me like you could use a beautiful tree in the 15 to 20 foot range area. Your neighbors have some big trees behind you, so it doesn't appear that you need privacy. And if I were in Oregon, boy, there's some small trees I'd be looking at up there, like Choenanthus or some of the red buds that are bigger that are actually more successful there than down here. There's a lot of really cool trees that you could do. And this one is just, as I say, this is pretty much what it's going to look like. Yes.
Well, she's in an area where she can walk up to the tree. What about having a little fruit tree, a short, keep it short?
Yeah, you got a fig tree right next to it. And figs are, by the way, figs are very big trees. Most people manage them to keep them smaller, and I see that's being done here, and I think that would be a good thing to continue doing. And you could fit another fruit tree in there if that was a preference, or a fruit tree that's really pretty. Yeah, what are
Yeah.
the
What
fruit
about
trees that are
that
really?
red peach tree that you like
Yeah,
so much?
red barren peach, which is a beautiful flower in the spring, and it's a I've been picking them. They're done now, but I pick them for almost 2 weeks. It has an interesting long harvest, long ripening. It softens quickly, but it's a wonderful peach and spectacular when it's in bloom. Also, one of the most beautiful fruit trees, if you happen to like the fruit, are persimmons. The Hashia and the Fuyu persimmons, they get big if you let them, but you can keep them shorter. Fall color is great. The fruit hangs on them beautifully into the winter. The songbirds like it. If you don't happen to eat them, the cedar waxwings will come in and enjoy them. So as an ornamental tree, persimmons are some of the best, and then the fruit is a nice bonus. And if you happen to like it, they're very easy to grow in our area, and I believe you would have no problem with them up where you are as well. So there's a lot of trees that will be, it's such a focal point. The only reason I'm suggesting this, I hate to, I always hate to have you take out a tree to which you might have some attachment, but it's such a focal point in the yard that probably a more attractive looking tree would be my inclination.
What about if this is the back of the yard next to the neighbor's fence? What about a pomegranate? Now, you don't have to get one that you have to eat the fruit on, because in Oregon you have lots of birds that would love to eat pomegranates.
Yes, indeed.
But it has the most beautiful orange
Yeah,
flowers.
they're very pretty. There's actually pomegranates that don't fruit. I have one. There's a fruitless double-flowered pomegranate that has, it's on the market. You can find it. And basically, a pomegranate is a large shrub. I have a neighbor who, for the first 20 plus years where we lived on this county road, was out there meticulously training her pomegranate up as a tree, which meant that every season, two or three times a year, she had to cut off all the suckers that were coming up from the base and maintain the single trunk. And finally, the property sold. The new folks moved in, immediately stopped doing that. And now they have giant pomegranate shrubs, because that's what a pomegranate really is. And they're about a 10 to 12 foot, maybe up to 15 feet. With great age, I suppose they could get to 20. And the flowers are very showy. They come on April to May. The fruit is very attractive. Most people wouldn't eat 50 to 100 pomegranates a year, but the birds, as
The
one of
birds
those,
would.
will certainly enjoy them. And some of your neighbors might enjoy sharing them. So pomegranates are a great ornamental fruit tree, much like persimmon, where the fruit just happens to be a nice bonus. If you want a citrus, well, Medford, Oregon is a place where it would be too cold for a lot of citrus, but you could grow a yuzu. You could grow, it would be hardy. You could grow kumquats. So there are citrus you could grow there as well. So now we've moved on to you're taking out your tree and we're making suggestions for what to put in. If I were gardening in Oregon, Washington, I'd probably have a very different range of trees on my property. The dogwoods and the things that just struggle here in the valley. But Medford is hot. I just had a customer in my nursery in the last week who was visiting Davis from Medford and came in and bought a whole bunch of plants to take back with him. Showed me pictures of the property, all kinds of lavenders, and interesting to me to see these Mediterranean plants that he was using. And he had to make sure, he told me, yeah, I had to make sure they're on a slope because we get rain late in the season, so they tend to rot. So they all had, water had to drain away. So you have an advantage. You're in one of the best places in the world for growing fruit trees. I mean, there's a lot of fruit species that you can grow in the Willamette Valley, and that's it's a wonderful soil and a great climate. You can do apples, you can do crab apples that are fruiting. You can have things like that that could be an ornamental tree, as well as having a nice bonus of some fruit, assuming you're willing to take out the catalpa.
I actually, looking at the broad picture that she sent, I love the fact that people send such nice photos. I think what would be lovely there would be a ginkgo.
Oh,
Because if
yeah.
you imagine the bright yellow in the fall, that's a gorgeous tree. No fruit, but
Well,
it's a.
you make sure you get the male trees so
That's
there's
right.
no fruit. Yes, very important.
It's very
Hey,
important.
folks, check for the graft union when you buy that ginkgo. Just looking at a ginkgo tree in a lawn, in a commercial landscape, tree's been in the ground for 8 or 10 years and it has fruit on it.
Uh-oh.
It's going to have to come out. And I hate to say this, but the smell of the fruit of the female trees, butyric acid is what's in them. It smells putrid. And once they start to fruit and the fruit drops and it's on a lawn and people walk across the lawn, it will definitely come out. And I looked, there was no graft union. So I don't know whether someone bought a tree that was being misrepresented as a male tree or whether they planted a male ginkgo and the top died and the rootstock came up. Both of those things do happen. But minor digression, really important, not only to buy a ginkgo that's being sold to you as a male tree, check for the graft union.
So here's a conversation that Don had, and it's about the Western Redbud, which is our California native, the Cirrus occidentalis. And the customer said the leaf's edges are burning, and there's black spots on the leaves of this Western Redbud.
And they
And
had a
Don
picture.
said,
They had a picture too. So this is
"Oh,
great. We
good."
always like that.
And Don said, "This is sunburn." And they said, "No, it's not sunburn. These are spots, like a rust disease."
Yeah. So spots on the leaves of a Western redbud are a response to stress and high temperatures. And we have a term for it. So when they walk in with leaves that have spots on them, we'll say that's edema, which is sounds like a disease, but it's actually just a description of the symptom. It's just a Greek word that means spots. Rust spores, this is important. When you're looking at a problem on a leaf, first thing I like to do is take my thumb and push on it. See what happens. Does it rub off or does it not rub off? If it was rust, which is a fungus, it'll rub off onto your thumb. And you look at your thumb and there's rust spores on your thumb now. This is just a staining. And this happens on, most commonly, we see it on citrus and red buds, where it just looks like the cells are leaking. We get extreme heat. We have a heat wave for a couple of days. We combine that with drought stress. And you realize that these blackened areas, they're not on the leaf, they're in the leaf. All right. They're part of the interior of the leaf. We're just seeing the symptoms on the outer part. And you take your thumb. No, of course it doesn't rub off because it's inside the leaf. It's some plants do this when they're exposed to extreme heat. If you're hiking around where the Western Redbud is actually native, which is kind of the bathtub ring around the valley, not the valley floor itself, but right around, slightly uphill in all directions, it's very common on Western Redbud here. They look rough in the mid to late summer. Our native plants look rough sometimes in the summer here. This is something I want people who are doing native plant installations to understand. Some of them drop leaves. Some of them go into a sort of a summer dormancy. Some of them get leaf burn, and that just happens. It's just very common on Western Redbud here. Our native redbud shows this more than non-native types in some cases. In the case of redbud, it really has to do with how thick the leaf is and how much of a waxy leaf coating it has. And Western Redbud is a fairly thin leaf and has a fairly thin waxy leaf coating. Even thinner and even less protected are the Eastern Redbud, the well-known Cirsus canadensis varieties that are very popular in older neighborhoods of Sacramento where they have a high canopy of trees shading them. Up in Oregon, back east, of course, Eastern Redbud. Same flower. They all have basically the same beautiful magenta pink flowers. And so they all look pretty much the same, but the thinner leafed and less waxy leaf coated ones scorch, look even worse than the Western Redbud. The exceptions are things like the Oklahoma Redbud. Oklahoma Redbud is a variant of the Eastern Redbud with a very thick leaf and a very thick waxy coating, and with even close to normal or acceptable watering and even some drought stress, we just don't get the burn on them as we do on the native Western Redbud. So we have this odd situation where the non-native cultivar, Oklahoma Redbud, is more attractive and successful here than our native Western Redbud. Nothing wrong with planting Western Redbuds. I got three or four of them on my property. I love them when they're in bloom. I grow them as shrubs because that's how they grow. They're never really a tree in this area. That you shouldn't try to grow them with just one single trunk for a reason we'll get to in a moment. And they do fine, but their summer appearance, I was just out looking at mine. It's a little rough. You know, they look a little burnt. They get the black spots on the leaves. Okay, that's not particularly harmful, but it is something to be aware of as an aesthetic consideration. The Eastern Redbuds, other than that Oklahoma variety, the Eastern Redbuds, I just don't recommend at all here in the valley and anywhere in interior Southern California or anywhere in the East Bay or places where we get up into the 90s or over 100 on a regular basis, where the humidity is as low as it gets here. When we hit 100 degrees last week, the humidity that day was 16%. And that's not quite desert level, but it's very low humidity. And some leaves just scorch or get these kind of weird black spots on them. So we just recommend, if you're doing it as a tree, as a real focal point, use the Oklahoma Redbud. If it's part of a mixed planting of other native woody plants and grasses and perennials, you'll be fine with it. It'll be in the background. And when it's in bloom in the spring, it'll be great. And up close appearance of the leaves can be a little rough, but they're fine. And that's actually normal and natural for them. But there's another problem with the Western Redbud. I sent Lois a picture of one of mine that I took 2 years ago of what had happened to one of my beautiful, flourishing, 8 foot tall Western Redbud.
And it's gone, man. I mean, the whole half of that bush is dead, orangish brown leaves.
Dead. Yeah, half
and of it. The leaves are hanging on to it. It's not like it shed leaves or anything. It's just poof.
Yeah, this happens on Western Redbud very commonly. And seriously, all I did with this plant 2 years ago, one whole side of it died. I would guess it's either a Botrytis furia disease or Cercospora. Those of you who know plant pathology would know those. At Botrytis furia in particular, they blow in, they splash in when we have a wet late spring rainfall, for example. We'll get an infection on one branch. Airborne. So this is not coming up from the soil. It's airborne. Everything past that point of infection dies. You prune it out. That's that. So I pruned that out 2 years ago. And if I took a picture of that same plant now, it looks fine. It was a little unbalanced at first. It promptly regrew to fill in that area and nothing has hit since. But this is an easy one. When it happens, you just prune out the dead portion and move on. No, you don't spray for it. No, you don't do a preventative. But this is why we don't recommend taking the Western Redbud, training it up with a single trunk, so that there's a central leader like a tree, because if you get this disease on that trunk, you kind of have to start over. Whereas if you have it as a multi-trunk and one branch dies, prune it out, plant will probably balance itself out very nicely. So we just don't recommend the Western Redbud as a tree. And we do want people to be aware that the summer appearance of it can be rough. Other than that, it grows fine and the spring blooms are spectacular.
Okay, Don, Here's a question from a customer. Do you have any tips for growing cilantro seeds? I'm trying to grow some indoor herbs.
Well, my first
Two
tip would don't.
questions. What's cilantro seeds?
Cilantro is, well, it's an herb that people grow for the leafy green. They add it to Mexican cuisine, and some of us hate it, and many people like it. It's a
But
standard ingredient.
isn't it something else too?
Coriander. Yes. If
Thank you.
you grow coriander, if you grow cilantro and let it flower and set seed, now you have coriander. It has a very pronounced flavor that some people love, and apparently there's a genetic quirk which makes a whole lot of us to us it tastes like soap. My mother had that same quirk. And so we don't like cilantro, but a lot of people do. And people who like it tend to really like it. Well, my tip for growing cilantro is don't try and do it indoors. Herbs in general are not indoor plants. I know they sell them at Trader Joe's and Nugget Market and places like that. And you see them indoors. They're also selling things like lavender, other plants. As long as
I've
your
grown these.
expectation is this plant will go for 5 or 6 weeks as an indoor plant, fine. If you really think it's going to be a long-term thing indoors, no. Almost all the things that we use as kitchen herbs are Mediterranean plants from full sun climates where they get heat and are relatively dry conditions. They're great garden plants. They're very good for low water landscapes. They're actually wonderful outdoors, and they're a lot easier in the ground than they are in containers. So people who are growing herbs generally do very well with them in, let's say, a big planter, not a little planter. They do well where they're in full sun. If you've got a difficult spot outside that's a hot, dry location, rosemary, oregano, sage, things like that. Basil and cilantro are grown as annuals, but cilantro, unlike basil, is a cool season annual for us. We plant it here in the fall. Usually we start selling at our nursery. I brought some in a couple of weeks ago because people wanted it, but I want them to know when they buy it, it's just going to flower right away. When you plant it in the summer, it just flowers immediately. So please keep your expectations low. But in October, if you plant it going into cooler weather, it will grow and produce leafy stuff all the way through till about February, and then it will flower. So if you're really a cilantro lover, we plant it here in the cool side of the season, October or February at the latest for use in late winter and early spring, and then it flowers. Of course, you can use the flowers. Also, important note, the flowers are very, very, very attractive to beneficial insects. So if it does flower, leave it out there and enjoy those. And when you have the seed, now you have coriander. But if people really like cilantro, we're not in the right place. The cilantro that you see in the grocery store comes in from coastal growers where they can grow it year round. Here, we're very seasonal with it, fall, spring. It's a little frost tender, but it usually gets through the winter. So, fall through the late winter, early spring. By May, it's done. By April, it's usually done. And it's very hard to keep cilantro going through the summer. It's definitely not a good indoor candidate. Basil, by comparison, can be grown indoors in a sunny window as long as your expectations are low. It's not going to be a big plant like you'd have in your garden, but you can snip a little bit and use it for a few weeks from a plant that you purchased at the grocery store.
Okay, so usually we end the show with a garden quote. This time I actually have two.
Oh,
Well, the
okay.
first one isn't really a garden quote, it's a Don quote.
Uh-oh.
Every year is a weird year. We were talking about, how hot it was last year, how cold it was this year.
Average, pretty good.
So the other is a garden quote, and this is from Christopher Lloyd. I don't know if you remember Christopher
Oh,
Lloyd.
yes. Yeah.
Yeah. How do you remember Christopher Lloyd?
Go on.
The great thing is not to be timid in your gardening, whether it's colors, shapes, juxtapositions, or the contents themselves. Splash around and enjoy yourself.
There you go. Just like in a pool. Splash around and enjoy yourself in the garden. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore.
And Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.